the headlines, another deadly day for Shia worshippers in Afghanistan. At least 41 people are killed as multiple bomb explosions hit a mosque in the country's south. A day of mourning in Lebanon. Funerals are held for some of the people who were killed by Christian Lebanese Forces Party in Beirut on Thursday. And also in our headlines, the COVID-19 pandemic keeps surging in Russia as Friday's toll reaches almost 1,000 and the number of infections jumps to over 32,000. Hello and welcome, everybody. Another deadly day in Afghanistan. Multiple bomb explosions have ripped through a Shia mosque during the Friday prayers in the city of Kandahar, leaving dozens of worshippers dead. More than 40 people are confirmed dead so far, while dozens more injured after three back-to-back explosions hit Imam Bargah Mosque. Hospital sources say the death toll could rise further. According to a Taliban official, the attack was carried out by a suicide bomber. Eyewitnesses, however, say there were several assailants, with one of them blowing himself up inside the mosque. The witnesses say two more attackers detonated their bombs in crowded areas outside the main building. They say they also heard gunfire. No group has yet claimed responsibility. Last Friday, more than 50 Shia worshippers lost their lives after a Daesh-claimed blast hit a mosque in the northern city of Kunduz. For more insight on that story, we're joined by international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, who's with us from London, Ontario. Mr. Corrigan, welcome to the program. Let's jump right in. I'd like to get your views on the recent violence that has unfolded in Kandahar in Afghanistan.
Well, of course, it's very tragic, and it's clear that somebody is trying to provoke a sectarian war between the Shias and the Sunnis. Who's going to benefit from that is, I think, the ultimate question, whether it's the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, which are actually, they're Sunni, but they are, you know, opposed to the Taliban, and the Taliban has sworn to strike them, to get rid of them, and they want, the Taliban are interested in projecting a more tolerant image to the world and have promised to protect the Shias. But there may be other groups. In Iraq, for example, there's evidence that the British, Americans, and the Israelis were setting off bombs to try to provoke a conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis, so it's easier to control. Perhaps that same tactic is being employed in Afghanistan, where you have, you know, British and American, you know, agents trying to provoke a civil war to pit the Sunni and the Shia and then to help destabilize the country. And out of that, they might be able to get some sort of control. But unfortunately, there are, you know, a Sunni extremists that are active with the Islamic State that are opposed to the Taliban and are only interested in chaos and are ideologically driven and would, you know, blow themselves up if it meant killing, you know, Shias. So it's a very dangerous situation, but they need to get to the source of the problem and who's behind these attacks. And if it's not brought under control quickly, there's a chance that the, you know, sectarian war will return to Afghanistan. And this is certainly not in the interest of the Taliban, not in the interest of the Shia population of Afghanistan. And it's hard to determine who would benefit, but only, you know, some very crazy Islamic State extremists would take such extreme measures. But, you know, for what purpose, it's hard to fathom, actually.
Well, Mr. Corrigan, I was going to address another question, but you brought up the issue of the source of the problem. Looking at Afghanistan today, would one of the sources of the problems that we're seeing in Afghanistan right now be the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, the two decades of the military occupation, and also the mess it left behind with the pullout from Afghanistan?
Well, clearly that's a big part of the problem. The United States and their NATO allies, you know, destroyed much of the infrastructure in Afghanistan, destroyed the social and cultural structure, and they put, well, over $2 trillion into it, but they didn't do any long-term benefits. The vast majority of Afghans are still poor. The majority of people still had no electricity, and, you know, there was no benefits. you know, even though the money went in, it only went to, you know, to warlords and it was stolen, and but it didn't do any long-term benefit. So the people in Afghanistan got little or no benefit of 20 years of American occupation in the country. And when the Americans pulled out, of course, the previous government collapsed and the Taliban basically just walked into power. So that's a major part of the problem. You need to build, you know, social, economic, and political structures that combine the various, you know, ethnic and religious groups in Afghanistan into a whole that they can work together and both help each other and benefit, you know, and by building Afghanistan. And, you know, it's only, I think, you know, Sunni extremists from Islamic State that would benefit from that, but they only want to create chaos. And it's very, very destructive, which is why many commentators, myself included, think that it could be the, you know, the CIA or British intelligence, MI6, or possibly even the Israelis that are trying to stir up problems and create chaos and destruction in their wake. And if that's the case, then it's, you know, it's a very, very serious problem that they need to get to the root cause, solve it, and eliminate the source of the problem, and of course, you know, bring peace back to Afghanistan.
And there are hints of an existing level of coordination between the United States and Daesh, probably in Afghanistan. How do you feel about that notion? And if so, what is the U.S. trying to gain with this type of action?
Well, it's hard to say what the U.S. is going to benefit from it, other than by creating chaos. They may be able to, you know, put pressure on the, you know, Afghan government to bring economic concessions. Afghanistan is actually a country that has estimated between $1 trillion or maybe even $3 trillion worth of mineral resources in the country, which is one of the reasons why the Americans went into the country in the first place. So there is resources there, but instead of, you know, building up constructive partnerships with the government in Afghanistan and the various social and economic forces in the country, they're stuck on this thing. We'll create chaos, and out of that, we'll try to extract some concessions. But, you know, this is the policy that was pursued in Syria and also in Iraq, and it quite frankly did not work. So, you know, there are elements within the CIA that have been playing this Islamic State card and supporting Daesh in order to create problems and to destroy the Syrian national government, and also to create, you know, civil war in Iraq. But in the long term, neither of those policies fail. But that doesn't mean they don't try, and of course they can create a lot of destruction and death, you know, as a consequence of these policies. The Pentagon actually tends to be working more with the ethnic group, especially the Kurds, which is much better, but there's still the CIA tendency to try to work with the Islamic extremist groups with some sort of benefit, but I would say that there is no benefit that has come out of this at all.
Well, Mr. Corrigan, the same goes for figures from the previous government, the now deposed Ashraf Ghani government. Could they also be in collusion with Daesh here?
I believe so, maybe some elements, but the previous government was, you know, opposed to Daesh, and they were trying to establish their own sort of political legitimacy and Daesh is, quite frankly, overwhelmed. It's out of control, and I don't see them causing anything, you know, for stability or for economic development or for peace. It's purely a destructive force, which is why the Israelis, the Americans, and the British were using it against Syria and in Iraq. And my guess is that they're still sort of stuck in this route and want to use it against Afghanistan. It's not a policy that has any sort of rational basis, and in the long term, it's not going to work.
Thanks a lot, international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, joining us from London, Ontario. Thank you for your comments, sir. Elsewhere, Iran's foreign ministry has strongly condemned a deadly terrorist attack on yet another Shia mosque in Afghanistan that left dozens of people dead. The ministry said the latest tragic incident in Kandahar and the previous such attack in Kunduz make it clear that Shia and Sunni religious sites and congregations in Afghanistan need to be protected. It also called for unity among Afghans, warning that the people in the country must be on guard against the divisive conspiracy being hatched by enemies of Islam. Tehran also expressed condolences and sympathy with the families of the victims and wished a speedy recovery for those wounded in the attack. In other news, a funeral ceremony has been held in Beirut for some of the victims of Thursday's attack on a protest rally in the Lebanese capital. The Lebanese government has declared Friday a national day of mourning. Seven people were killed and dozens wounded after a protest came under gun and bomb attacks. The protest was called by the resistance movement Hezbollah and the Amal movement against a judge investigating last year's devastating Beirut port blast. The protesters accused the judge of being under U.S. influence. At least nine people have been arrested in connection with the violence. Earlier, Hezbollah and Amal blamed members of a Christian party, Lebanese forces, for being behind the attacks, saying they had planned the confrontation in advance. New reports say Interior Ministry officials have unanimously agreed on that narrative. President Michel Aoun has also pledged to hold the perpetrators to account.
What happened will be the subject of security and judicial follow-up, and I, for my part, will ensure that the investigation reaches the truth of what happened in order to hold those responsible and instigators to account.
Meanwhile, Hezbollah said it would not be dragged into civil war, but at the same time would not let the blood of the victims go in vain. Lebanon's Supreme Islamic Shia Council also decried the unrest as an unspeakable crime. There had been reactions from outside Lebanon, too. Iran condemned the killing of the protesters. It said the Lebanese people, government, and army, alongside the resistance, would successfully overcome the Israeli-backed sedition plot. Russia called on all sides in Lebanon to show restraint, and the UN urged Lebanese parties to refrain from provocative acts. The situation in Lebanon is once again making headlines as the country, already suffering from a severe economic meltdown, has been hit by deadly violence. As we'll see in this following report, there are fears of conflict following an attack in the capital, Beirut.
Lebanon is on the edge in the wake of a deadly attack on protesters in the capital, Beirut, on Thursday. Chaotic scenes erupted as gunmen opened fire on supporters of resistance movement Hezbollah and the Amal movement. Lebanese Interior Minister Bassam Maulawi said snipers aimed at people's heads. The protesters were marching near the Justice Palace to demand the removal of the judge investigating the massive blast at Beirut's port last year. Hezbollah and Amal blamed the Lebanese forces, a Christian party, for the attack. They said the bloodshed was aimed at dragging Lebanon into conflict. Lebanon has been moving from crisis to crisis over the past years and is now suffering from a crippling economic meltdown. Who benefits from violence and possible sectarian strife at this critical point?
There are numerous actors within Lebanon as well as in the region and internationally that would, of course, benefit from the destabilization of Lebanon, and that would love to see more insecurity within Lebanon. This is, of course, primarily the Zionist entity, the Israeli regime, as well as, of course, the United States to some extent, and their regional allies, as well as proxies within Lebanon that have been invested for many years now in trying to coerce the resistance, particularly Hezbollah, into disarming in order to further put Lebanon into their own sphere of influence.
The latest violence is tied to the ongoing probe into last year's mega explosion. The investigation is led by controversial judge Tarek Bitar. Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri and Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah have become increasingly outspoken in their criticism of the blast probe.
Political tensions have been growing in Lebanon over the probe into last year's devastating blast, which killed more than 200 people. Judge Tarek Bitar was appointed to the Beirut Explosion Inquiry earlier in 2021. There have been complaints and accusations of bias against the 47-year-old judge.
The ongoing investigation into last year's huge blast has become a serious bone of contention among political parties in Lebanon. Lebanese people want the real culprits to be held accountable, but the probe has been dogged with controversy and is failing to move forward. The investigation has been suspended on several occasions, with its lead judges accused of bias. Two former cabinet ministers, Ali Hassan Khalil and Ghazi Zaitar, who are currently lawmakers with the Amal movement, are now at the center of controversy. Investigators have accused them and other prominent politicians, like former caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab, of negligence. Hezbollah and Amal insist that the investigation is highly politicized and is somehow targeting their allies. The national probe has become extremely complicated and threatens to deepen the problems of the crisis-hit country.
There has been major difficulties in actually proceeding with the process and with the judiciary dimension of it. And one reason for that is, of course, that the court bust has been politicized right from the beginning. There were also issues with transparency, and Hezbollah has demanded to make the reports public, also the reports that were drafted by foreign investigations, which other parties have refused, and Hezbollah has also asked for the judiciary to be investigated, which is what the judge apparently has refused.
Observers believe Lebanon needs to find a way to overcome problems surrounding the inquiry very quickly and then focus on its crippling economic woes if it wants to prevent the system from total collapse. An unprecedented economic crisis has left Lebanon severely short of fuel and other basic necessities. Will different political parties be able to bridge their differences and try to save their country?
Saudi Arabia says it's serious about restoring relations with the Islamic Republic, calling the talks with Iranian officials cordial. Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud has also described meetings with Iran as friendly, saying Riyadh is always seeking a way to stabilize the region. Media reports suggest Riyadh is considering an Iranian request to open its consulate in the city of Jeddah and reopen its representative office for the Organization of Islamic Cooperation there. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, also earlier said the negotiations between Riyadh and Tehran are proceeding on the right path. Iran and Saudi Arabia have held four rounds of talks since April. The kingdom also held its first meeting last month with the government of new Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi. And that's a wrap for this edition of the World News. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Climate change is the single biggest health threat facing humanity, the UN agency says. While no one is safe from the health impacts of climate change, they are disproportionately felt by the most vulnerable and disadvantaged. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Burning of Fossil Fuels is Killing Us, WHO Warns in COP26 Report. Stay tuned for more. Looking toward the United Nations summit scheduled for the end of the month, a top UN agency recently released a report that makes a health argument for climate action and calls on governments and policymakers to urgently tackle the emergency. The burning of fossil fuels is killing us, warns the World Health Organization report, noting that the practice is causing millions of premature deaths every year through air pollutants, costing the global economy billions of dollars annually and fueling the climate crisis. In the foreword, WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus highlights that human-caused global heating is impacting droughts, extreme heat, floods, hurricanes, and wildfires, he adds. Climate change is the single biggest health threat facing humanity. And while no one is safe from the health impacts of climate emergency, they are disproportionately felt by the most vulnerable and disadvantaged. Adds, protecting people's health from climate change requires transformational action in every sector, including on energy, transport, nature, food systems, and finance. The public health benefits from implementing these ambitious climate actions far outweigh their cost. Tedros, in a statement, added, COVID-19 pandemic has shone a light on the intimate and delicate links between humans, animals, and the environment. The same unsustainable choices that are killing our planet are killing people. The same unsustainable choices that are killing our planet are killing people, the agency leader added, underscoring how important COP26, the upcoming UK-hosted summit that will be held in Glasgow, Scotland, is to meet the goals of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. WHO calls on all countries to commit a decisive action at COP26 to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because in our own interest. WHO's new report highlights 10 priorities for safeguarding the health of people and the planet that sustain us. The priorities of the WHO explained at length in this report are commit to a healthy recovery. The health is not negotiable. Harness the health benefits of climate action. Build health resilience to climate risks. Create energy systems that protect and improve climate and health. Reimagine urban environments, transport and mobility. Protect and restore nature as the foundation of our health. Promote healthy, sustainable, and resilient food systems. Finance a healthier, fairer, and greener future to save lives. And listen to the health community and prescribe urgent climate action. The report comes a few weeks after the WHO updated its guidelines on air quality for the first time in over 15 years, warning that air pollution is now recognized as the single biggest environmental threat to human health. And the burden of disease attributable to it is estimated to be on a par with other major global health risks, such as unhealthy diet and tobacco smoking. Pointing to the new standards, which reflect the impact of fossil fuels on humans, Dr. Maria Neera, WHO's Director of Environment, Climate Change and Health, said recently that it has never been clearer that the climate crisis is one of the most urgent health emergencies we all face. Bringing down air pollution to WHO guideline levels, for example, would reduce the total number of global deaths from air pollution by 80%, while dramatically reducing the greenhouse gas emissions that fuel climate change, she said. A shift to more nutritious, plant-based diets in line with WHO recommendations, as another example, could reduce global emissions significantly, ensure more resilient food systems, and avoid up to 5.1 million diet-related deaths a year by 2050. The new report was released alongside an open letter from 450 organizations representing over 45 million health workers, along with more than 3,400 individuals from 102 different countries. As health professionals and health workers, we recognize our ethical obligation to speak out about this rapidly growing crisis that could be far more catastrophic and enduring than the COVID-19 pandemic, the letter says of the climate emergency. We call on leaders of every country and their representatives at COP26 to avert the impending health catastrophe by limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, the letter adds, and to make human health and equity central to all climate change mitigation and adaptation actions. The letter, which provides examples of how the climate emergency is already impacting human health and specific recommendations for moves that policymakers can pursue, concludes that these climate actions must be taken now to protect the planet, the earth, the health, well-being, and prosperity of all people alive today and for generations to come.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Brothers in Crime.
More than 100,000 men have been sexually assaulted in the U.S. military in recent decades. The U.S. military tolerates sexual harassment. The number of women in the military assaulted is also staggering. Commanders often ignore reports and punish the victims instead.
A video posted by a female Marine about sexual assault in the military rocketed across the internet and into the Pentagon press briefing room today. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin promised to take additional steps to stop such violence. But as Nick Schifrin reports, sexual assault in the military continues to rise, and individual families continue to be ripped apart.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. In this episode, we will explore heinous sexual crimes going on for years in the U.S. military, and it is not only against women. Thousands of men are sexually assaulted in the military and often do not report it. Stay tuned for more.
Sexual assault in the military has long been swept under the rug, covered up for rationalized acts of hazing or bullying, but now we're learning more about the men who were victimized during their time serving the country. Pentagon statistics show an average of 10,000 men each year are sexually assaulted in the U.S. military. Most of the victims are usually younger, lower-ranking males who struggle to report the incidents.
Nearly one in four U.S. service women reports being sexually assaulted in the military. The New York Times magazine calls it the epidemic of military sexual assault. Most assaults go unreported, and from the ones that do get reported, only a very small fraction end in a conviction. For instance, in 2020, there were 6,200 reports of offenses made, but only 50, which is less than 1%, ended in sex offense conviction.
According to the U.S. Department of Defense, 24% of women and 6% of men in the military endured severe, persistent sexual harassment. Of the small margin who actually tried to complain, the majority were told to drop the matter. Here with us is our first guest, Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Good to be with you.
All right, now, Scott, what is the situation of sexual assault like today in the U.S. military?
Well, the U.S. military has, in a way, been in a slow train wreck deconstruction, demolition for the past 50 years, ever since the Vietnam War, and the American military, essentially from the Vietnam War before, was all men. After the Vietnam War, the military academies and the military services began to increasingly bring women in to roles that were previously not simply nursing or clerical, but actual physical involvement with duties that were very close to men in situations and scenarios. So as a result of the American military opening up a lot of its previously closed doors to women, you've had an increase steadily in the incidence of sexual harassment, sexual molestation, rape, also physical violence and things like that.
Thank you for joining us on the program, Mr. Scott Bennett.
From 2009 to 2015, more than 22% of service members who left the military after reporting a sexual assault received a less than fully honorable discharge. This is according to a 2016 investigation by the Department of Defense's Office of the Inspector General.
That is nearly 1.5 times more than the percentage of overall service members who received less than fully honorable discharges from 2002 through 2013. Our second guest, Dr. Rick Stagenberg, is a retired Veterans Affairs psychiatrist who's now a social and political commentator and an activist for peace and universal health care in the U.S. Thanks for joining us, sir.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Now, what is a culture of the military which results in these assaults?
I think it's going to take, they're going to have to get serious about prosecuting the offenders before the other ones will think twice. I mean, because of the hierarchical nature of the military, it's very easy to fall into that, even people that might not otherwise, certainly not in civilian life, would not be assaulting their subordinates, seem to think they can get away with it. Violence is a way is considered normal in the military. So, I mean, in the Marines, part of the training is to, you know, get beaten and beat others until you're tougher. I understand that's changed some since I was in the military, but I doubt it's changed a lot. So it's a culture. It's going to be hard to change.
That was Dr. Rick Stagenberg there joining us. Thank you, sir.
Many service members leave the military soon after experiencing sexual trauma, and not voluntarily. Not only are military rapists rarely punished, but their victims are often punished for reporting what happened. According to a 2018 survey of active duty service members by the Department of Defense, 38% of service women who reported their assaults experienced professional retaliation afterward.
Morgan Robinson knew from a young age she wanted to join the military.
When she turned 21, she said, "Mom, I gotta talk to you." And she told me then that she had joined.
She'd been in the Army National Guard 6 years when she was sent on her first deployment to Kuwait in 2016.
What happened to Morgan while she was serving abroad?
When she was in Kuwait, she was sexually assaulted and continually harassed by one of her superiors.
Did she report it?
Yes, she reported it.
What was the response when she reported it?
Nothing. She got nothing.
While on that same deployment, Morgan was sent to Afghanistan, where she was sexually assaulted again. An alleged gang rape involving multiple fellow soldiers.
According to Deputy Director of the Defense Department's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office, for generations, the military wasn't looking for male sexual assault victims, so it failed to see them. Only in 2006, after the office began surveying service members, did the military learn that at least as many men as women were being assaulted.
Also in the military have joined the military to purposefully and intentionally bring in homosexuality into the military. This was done under Obama and also under Bill Clinton. So there has been, since the 1990s, a steady increase in homosexual members of the military. And that has created an environment where certain young men are groomed or in some cases lured into compromising positions by senior officers that may have more of a homosexual inclination. So you have a lot of those incidents.
A report published in May indicates that while the share of male victims who come forward has been rising recently, an estimated 4 out of 5 still do not report the attack. Why are so many men assaulted in the military?
Well, it's primarily because rape and sexual violence are crimes of aggression, not passion. That's a common mistake. When people are, how shall I say, well, people tend to become more callous after they've undergone military training, especially if they've been in combat.
Billy Joe Capshaw was 17 years old when he joined the Army and was stationed at Baumhalder Army Garrison in Germany in 1980 and was assigned to share a room with Jeffrey Dahmer, who was an Army medic and later came to be arrested in 1991 for being a serial rapist and killer. Jeffrey Dahmer had raped and killed 17 young men and boys, dismembered, and ate them. And during Capshaw's time in the military, he was constantly beaten, drugged, and raped by Dahmer, who never told anyone.
Shortly before midnight on July the 22nd, 1991, two Milwaukee police officers were flagged down in their patrol car by a man with a pair of handcuffs dangling from one wrist. The police had no idea that this bizarre encounter would lead to the arrest of one of the most prolific serial killers in U.S. history.
That night, people were afraid. People were whispering under their breaths, "You know, it's the devil. It's the devil."
The man had escaped from a small one-bedroom apartment on North 25th Street. When the officers went to investigate, they found themselves in a living nightmare.
They saw the body parts, and then one of the officers said he heard a scream. Then he realized later he was the one who screamed when he saw the body.
Without detection, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer had killed 17 young men across a 13-year period.
One of the main reasons troops who are victims of sexual assault hardly ever see justice is the way in which such crimes are investigated and prosecuted. Under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the military commanders decide whether to investigate and follow legal action. Some politicians have been fighting and failing for years to change these military laws. We asked Dr. Stangenberg about the current situation.
Well, according to the report that came out in July, there has not been any improvement. I haven't seen specific statistics, but when I was working for the VA, it was pretty horrible. I saw most of the women I saw had been sexually traumatized one way or the other, and it's my impression that it's the same thing, but they are working on it.
Thank you, Doctor, and viewers, stay tuned for more.
Every year since 2013, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York has introduced legislation to move the decision to prosecute major military crimes, including sex crimes, out of the hands of commanders and into those of independent prosecutors. And every year it has failed to move forward.
The commanders, up until now, have been very reluctant to investigate these in many cases, if not most, and even when they do, they frequently punish the person who speaks, so it inhibits other people from reporting.
Historically, the Pentagon has vehemently opposed the idea, saying that it would undermine institutional leadership. During a 2019 Senate hearing, Vice Admiral John G. Hanning, Judge Advocate General of the Navy, testified that removing authority over serious crimes from commanders would have a detrimental impact on the ability of those commanders and other commanders to ensure good order and discipline.
Our Navy regulations emphasize the great responsibility of the commanding officer for his or her command. And it states that the authority of the commanding officer is commensurate with his or her responsibility. In my view, it must remain so. And this authority should not be eroded.
Sexual assault is often the initial signal event in a long line of painful trauma, which can culminate in post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and suicide. In a 2019 study, scientists surveyed more than 300 service women and female veterans who had experienced sexual assault and found that 29% were currently contemplating suicide. Now, from 2007 to 2017, the age-adjusted suicide rate among women veterans rose by 73%. In 2019, women accounted for 31% of all suicide attempts among active duty service members.
I saw ones that were traumatized to the point that they had post-traumatic stress disorder. And again, I saw only a tiny proportion of the women that had been affected by that. Most of them just try to bury it. They never even report it. If they do start suffering symptoms, they don't want to go to the VA because it's sort of a military-style way of delivering services. It's kind of militarized in the way they run it. They're constantly praise the military and the heroes. And these women were victimized by some of those people that are called heroes. These women were victimized by people who were supposed to have their back. And when you think about it for a moment, you can see, obviously, when you're traumatized by the very people that are supposed to be trying to protect you, as you are protecting them, it's doubly bad.
Since military sexual assault triggers multiple traumas, victims repeatedly experience feelings of betrayal, isolation, and worthlessness. Surveys show that the environment in which women are assaulted in the military are atmospheres where women often feel that they don't belong in, and they are usually assaulted by the men they work with, and at times they are their direct superior. So they have to constantly see them and work with them feeling that they might be assaulted again.
Many in the military who experience sexual harassment or being preyed upon or date rape or gang raped in any way drugged, that's one of the very, very big dangers and problems is the drugging of women that causes them to become incapacitated and thereby make them victims of sexual predators. Most of these women that experience this are very much ashamed and just want to forget it and don't want to draw attention. They don't want to draw any sort of investigation that could mar or blacken their character.
Many of the victims of sexual assault leave the military involuntarily. It is not just the rapist often goes unpunished, but the victim actually receives punishment for reporting the offense. According to a 2018 survey by the Department of Defense, 30% of servicewomen who reported assaults in the military received professional retaliation.
In December 2019, she arrived at Fort Bliss in Texas, an 18-year-old soldier.
She was a very, very proud soldier. In her basic trainings, First Sergeant loved her and praised her.
But she left the military draped in a flag. She'd been found dead on New Year's Eve 2020 in her barracks at age 19.
She got raped by a fellow soldier in December. She reported it in February. She was told to shut up. And the rapist was in her barracks, in her company, and she had to see him.
Graham moved in with her brother off base to get away from her alleged attacker. The siblings had always been close. Anthony saw his sister's descent. She started drinking and taking pills and became self-destructive. She got a DUI. She died of an overdose.
Many of the victims who decide to leave the military have not received a full honorable discharge. This is called a bad paper discharge, which can cut veterans off from jobs and VA services, as well as education benefits. The 2020 Veterans Legal Clinic report found that the VA has denied services to as many as 400,000 potentially eligible veterans.
So the military really isn't equipped, nor does it have the imperative to educate and morally train soldiers in relationship dimensions. That is one of the key areas that the American military family is left up to its own devices. Anything regarding morality, anything regarding sexual relationships or dating or any of these activities or just human relationships in general, the military does not engage that. The military is specifically inclined to training soldiers to perform specific tasks that fall within the military strategy of fighting wars, defeating enemies. And those are very limited training modules.
According to the New York Times, in group therapy, a woman named Jessica told the group that she had jumped off a second-floor balcony and shattered her pelvis to escape a Navy soldier who was trying to kill her. Another woman said that she was tied up, threatened with a razor blade, and raped in Japan on a Navy deployment when she was 19. She reported it the next day, but her assailant walked.
So it's a very complicated phenomenon, the nature of sexual relationships in the U.S. military, and it's a very sordid and ugly a problem in many, many regards, but it has been predictable because when the American military started opening up the doors and allowing and encouraging men and women to be working in close quarters and close situations, doing many of the same jobs, it was only inviting these problemed relationships and scenarios. And it also has depleted the America's combat effectiveness, and like I said, transformed the American military from a lethal war machine into now a social experiment.
Military-wide survey released back in 2019 reveals that alcohol use is a main contributing factor in sexual assaults and was involved in over 62% of these incidents against women. Assaults had increased across all branches of the military, but the Marine Corps, which has more young, low-ranking troops and far less women than other services, reported by far the highest rates of assaults. 10% of women surveyed in the Marines reported being assaulted, which is twice the rate of either the Army or the Air Force.
The results obtained by USA Today estimated 20,500 incidents of unwanted sexual contact involving personnel from the four armed forces branches in 2018. The study defined the range for assault as groping to rape. According to USA Today, the study showed that 85% of sexual assault victims knew their assailant, and in 62% of cases, alcohol was involved.
This survey indicated that the rate of assaults on men in the military was far less than on women, About 1% of men surveyed said they had been assaulted in the previous year, with the highest incidents reported in the Navy. Even though, according to the survey, troops were experiencing more assaults, they were less likely than before to report them.
You know, a lot of people were thrown out of the military and had their entire identity taken away. So whatever trauma they were going through just from being assaulted was compounded because they were fired. They were sent home, often under a cloud of shame. This oftentimes happened, you know, when people were 19, 20 years old, right when they're trying to form their identity, and it really sent them sprawling. So, you know, men that I spoke to who were assaulted in the 1960s and 70s, they spent decades trying to hide this, even oftentimes from themselves, and the damage to their lives was tremendous.
The staggering number of sexual violence, assault, and harassment on both men and women in the U.S. military more than anything shows the lack of ethics and moral character in the country's most important force of imperialism.
The United States military and many of its bases around the world, such as Okinawa, the Philippines, Germany, the U.S. military has also had many of its members engage in the rape, molestation, unwanted attention of the local female population. From Korea to Japan to Germany, there are many, many incidents of U.S. military members going off of base and going to bars or other places and engaging in very immoral activities and also in outright criminal activities. So this has been a source of animosity and friction among many of the countries in which the U.S. has positioned itself and had bases. The Japanese and Okinawa have reacted with a great deal of hostility and political protest.
These actions also show the weakness that lurks among soldiers, officers, and superior officers who are either perpetrators or involved in the cover-up of such heinous crimes against the weak.
Crimes that are also inflicted upon communities and countries where the military is stationed for one reason or another and is often harshly criticized by governments and people who are hosting them. These soldiers who have no mercy on their fellow comrades will obviously have no mercy on ordinary foreign citizens either. Well, that was our show, everyone. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.